Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. First, we get an update on the North Atlantic right whales. These critically endangered species spend part of the year feeding in the waters around the Cape and Islands. While they've already moved north, researchers were able to collect data on their behavior and numbers while they were here. Joining us once again is Dr. Michael Moore. He's Emeritus Research Scholar at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and author of We Are All Whalers. Welcome back. Always good to see you.
You too. Thank you.
So let's start with the best estimate of numbers of right whales and how many new calves we've seen this year.
Right. The best estimate is always a guess. You know, it's a model between good news, bad news, around 370, something like that. And the calves this year is 11. We've had 11 calves.
Right. And you sent a great link from the New England Aquarium that documents the female right whales that have calves this year and the amount of information we have about individual whales. It's pretty remarkable. Their age, what year they last had calves, when they were entangled. It's a wealth of information. And as someone who's been researching right whales for decades, what stands out to you from this year's spring calving season?
Well, the whales are still here. They're doing their thing. They're breeding, they're feeding, and if we leave them alone, they'll do just fine. And so, you know, the opportunity we have to go out, permitted research, to do essentially a health assessment of these animals on an annual basis is a huge privilege for us. There's four of us in the team, myself, Regina, Carolyn, and Catherine, and sometimes we get guests coming with us, but they're there. They're looking kind of skinny. The calves are fat, and, you know, they're still, the species is struggling to grow. But they're still there. They're doing their thing.
I think probably what's astounding is that we haven't had any mortalities, right?
Yeah, this year for 2025, zero so far. We have the ongoing unusual mortality event that NOAA has been curating since 2017. You know, I used to chair that panel, and the question is always, well, when does unusual become usual mortality? Mm. You know, and but what it does is it brings federal focus and discussion and priority to the species by having that event going on.
So HUI recently partnered with the Massachusetts Department of Marine Fisheries to launch two new buoys off Cape Ann and in Cape Cod Bay. How do these buoys work, and what have we learned from the data that's been collected so far?
Well, it's a remarkable project that Mark Baumgartner at HUI has been leading. I was looking at his website last night. It's, I forget the title now, but anyway, it's a beautiful site where you can go and look at. He's got 13 different systems on the East Coast and one on the West Coast now, mainly buoys, either buoys or gliders. And the technology within the hardware listens to what is in the soundscape of the ocean around that each installation and distills out information that relates to definite or possible detections of different whale species. So if you go on the site, you can see that 3 days ago, the last right whales were heard in Cape Cod Bay for this year. And prior to that, they were heard every day since when the buoy was activated, which was February the 23rd, I think. So it's a wonderful way of backing up the information that's available, say, from aerial surveys done by the Center for Coastal Studies as to when the whales are gone, and so the state can then manage the fishery that was closed for lobster fishing with end lines through the winter every year since 2015. So it's excellent technology and use of it to do that.
And what a great thing to have. You've got the Center for Coastal Studies doing their aerial surveys, as you said. You've got the buoys, and you kind of combine all that information from these different organizations, and it gives you a real good picture.
It does, and also on a real-time basis when we're doing our research. I check the buoy, I look at the most recent data from the Center for Coastal Studies, and we plan our day or not, as the case may be, and we look at the weather too.
Yeah. Is there a plan to expand the buoys to other locations, maybe closer to shipping lanes?
Well, there has been, and I'm ignorant of where it's at, but there used to be at least a string of buoys around the Boston shipping lanes. And I'm not sure if they're still funded or not, but certainly, you know, around both coasts, the use of quote-unquote passive acoustics is huge. And there's a lot of different acoustic receiving information from Newfoundland down to Florida, right whale habitat.
Yeah. Marine mammals can be, as you know, challenging to study. Tell us some more about the use of drones to collect imagery of right whales and what those images can reveal about the health of the population.
Right. Well, drones carried on from the MANDA aerial photogrammetry work that we collaborated with back in 2002 in the Bay of Fundy, where Wayne Perriman would fly in a plane and measure the animals by flying a vertical photograph. And if you know good altitude, you can count the pixels and you can measure the length and width. And so when drones came along as more affordable options and safer because you're not putting humans in the air, in 2013 or so is when we started working with Wayne to do that with large whales. And that has evolved through various levels of the technology so that we can put up a small drone from a boat with a small camera and a good camera and a good lens and get remarkable images, both stills and videos. So we can fly over individually recognized whales along with all the information that the right whale catalog, as we talked earlier, has for the information from the calves, for the moms and so on. We know their entanglement history. We know their vessel strike history, their calving history. And each year we come back and often the same whales can get another photograph and another data point and another health assessment. So what we're able to do is use these drones for an annual health checkup for many of the individuals in the species, which is pretty extraordinary. You know, this year we went out on, I think, 12 days between January and May, and we flew over 189 whales. Some of them will have been duplicates, but, you know, what we've learned so far, and obviously, you know, data analysis in a long-term project like that takes time. Probably the most staggering piece of information, Josh Stewart, who's a collaborator from NOAA at the time, showed that if you were born in the 80s, you had a growth expectation as an adult to be a meter longer than if you were born in recent years. So these animals are stunted at this point, and that's really concerning.
Wow. There's some amazing drone footage of mothers and calves. Describe some of the behaviors that were captured in that.
Yeah. Well, you know, mostly we take stills because they're better quality images for the measurements. But we also take videos because then you can catch the moment when the photograph is the best for that. So in the process of doing that, we get to fly at about 140 feet over these animals for a protracted length of time till we get the best images. And it's become something that I live for because the opportunity of real time listening to the animals blowing, the boat we have is really quiet, the whales really seem to like it. It's an extraordinary experience. And when I have guests on the boat, I try to get them to look at the second monitor and say, just watch this. Because every time they just melt, it's so beautiful. The first thing we learned a few years back was that by the time the right whale moms and calves get to Cape Cod Bay, the calves have got sufficient mobility that the moms don't wait for them. They're hungry because they're lactating heavily, and they are busily feeding like any right whale does, pushing hard with their tail, the prop essentially, through the water, mouths open, sucking down those copepods, processing the oil, and at the other end comes the milk. And as the calf comes up for a breath every few minutes, but dies down under, and we can just see the little tail of the calf flapping under the tail of the mom. We know where they are. They're plugged in and they're doing their thing. So extraordinary behavior to sort of witness and document that going on routinely. Well, this year we also saw a couple of animals doing things that I hadn't recorded before, which is what really looked more restful or playful or whatever, but they weren't under the water except when they came out to blow. They were basically, I guess, swimming along with the mom. But one animal in particular, he started off at the tail and he just sort of wriggled his way along. And I wish I could swim like those guys. They just extraordinary behavior. And this animal started at the tail and sort of worked across along her back while mom was at the surface breathing, finally got up to the blowhole. And it was as if she sort of shrugged and said, "To heck with you." And down she went. And the calf said, "Oh, I'm coming down too." So I think these videos have got science value, but they've also got understanding and aesthetic qualities too, that that we share them as best we can.
I know you've said this long ago, that if this were a land animal and we could see what they go through in some of the entanglements and the horrible deaths they have, there would be such outrage. And maybe it's videos like these that make us emphasize, you know, have a little more empathy for.
Well, since I wrote my book, I've been desperately struggling to figure out, well, what's the next image? What's the frame? How can we make people understand how important these animals are? And I woke up at 3 this morning. It was half a dream, half awake. And boom, they're trees. They're the same scale as trees. They sequester carbon. They process nitrogen. They're big. They're beautiful. They're part of the ecosystem. And at man's cost, do we lose them?
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. So at this time of year, the North Atlantic right whales have moved north. How do researchers in Canada and the U.S. collaborate on monitoring this population?
Well, again, we come back to the right whale catalog. It's maintained by the Newland Aquarium. Contributions from all over the North Atlantic Ocean, the photographs of the individual animals go to the aquarium, and then they get processed and cataloged and curated into the ongoing life history story of each of these individuals. And the Canadians are, you know, fundamentally working in the same zone. They have their own systems for conservation of minimizing vessel strike, minimizing entanglement costs, providing fisheries that are timed to get most of the snow crab, if not all of it, quotas collected before the whales show up. And so, you know, they have their own particular challenges and solutions and systems, but there's a huge transboundary conversation that carries on year in, year out. And that, in many ways, is integrated by an annual meeting. We have the North Atlantic Right Whale Consortium, where we sometimes meet in Canada, sometimes in the U.S., and we get together to discuss what we know and what we worry about and what to do next.
Mm. You know, we talk about how beautiful these animals are, and I think you can actually, when they're here, see them closer from land, and mostly in Provincetown, you know, at Herring Cove or out at Race Point, better than you can in a boat, because you can't get close to them unless you have, you know, a license to do that.
Sure.
But I was out with Stormy Mayo from Center for Coastal Studies, and there was like one right whale at the time that everybody, you know, they're trying to find. And it happened to be one of those magical moments, because as we're, you know, tooling out to find this one right whale, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, hundreds of dolphins, hundreds and hundreds. It was like, I couldn't believe it was happening. And Stormy was like, too bad we're not counting dolphins today, right? But you get these magical moments out there that, you know, and the producer that was with me said, it's so nice to be seeing them here doing what they're supposed to be doing rather than, you know, covering a story where they're stranded. But it was just unbelievably magical.
This winter, we had a day where we came across what we call a surface active group, which is, you know, sometimes tens of right whales all cavorting around and having sex. And normally, you know, we shy away from them from the photogrammetry because they're wriggling and they're not straight. We need to measure straight whales, but they're fascinating. So we came across this sag, we call it, and it was pouring with rain. So we just sat there and watched these whales for 2 hours.
Wow.
And it was the most remarkable thing. And then it's, okay, fine, stop raining, get the drone up, let's take some photographs. Boom, they were all gone. Just done.
No paparazzi, please. Yeah. We're talking North Atlantic right whales with Michael Moore. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about North Atlantic right whales with Dr. Michael Moore. He's Emeritus Research Scholar at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and author of We Are All Whalers. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Cape Cod Bay is part of the Gulf of Maine, and the temperature of the Gulf is rising rapidly due to human-induced climate change. Over the course of the last couple decades, are we seeing those warming waters influence when the whales are in Cape Cod Bay and how long they stay in our waters? Following the food, right? It's really.
I'm not the oceanographer you need to talk about temperature variations at all, but I can tell you what I know about what the whales have done. Essentially, one of the things they did was they abandoned the Bay of Fundy, which was a major site up until about 2013, thereabouts, and they moved north in around the Gulf of St. Lawrence for the summers, much more than they used to. But in terms of Cape Cod Bay, we're certainly seeing more right whales each season. I mean, seasonally, it's been a thing, and Stormy Mayo was involved in that. I think probably early 80s is when Stormy started working with the feeding behavior of right whales in Cape Cod Bay. And the season is essentially February through early May. And it all depends upon the food quality. Now, basically, Cape Cod Bay is kind of like a fuel filter for the Gulf of Maine in general, because all the copepods go around in the counterclockwise current that comes down the coast, and they land up getting caught in Cape Cod Bay this time of year. So that's where the oil is in the copepods, and that's where the food is until it's not. And so Stormy's always said, well, is Cape Cod Bay the best place to be, or is it the least worst? And that, I think, is very, very savvy in terms of we don't know what will happen next, and the whales will tell us and the copepods will tell us before we figure that out, I'm sure. So, you know, right now the modeling for Center for Coast Studies does a lot of plankton surveys to try and get a sense of when the whales are going to leave, when they're going to come, and where they're going to be in the bay. And so much of that is, it's hard to forecast faster than the whales can figure it out. So the whales are definitely smarter than us when it comes to figuring out where the food is in that context.
Are ship strikes and entanglement in fishing gear still the biggest threat to the whales?
Those are the data we have, certainly. We see whales dead on the beach and floating at sea, entangled in rope and cut with propellers and bruised up with the vessel collisions if it's not being chopped up.
Can you remind listeners why right whales are more vulnerable to these human activities than other marine mammals?
Well, they are slow and they are cumbersome sometimes, and I'm not sure they are necessarily any more susceptible. We worry about them more because of their rarity. Humpback whales get entangled, they get hit by ships and so on. One of the things is that the species-specific behaviors tune the particulars of how these human interactions occur. So, for instance, right whales feed going through the water with their mouths open, and they quite often are in areas that are also good for lobstering. So they run through these vertical line forests and they get entangled there. Humpback whales have the same problem, but they also feed on faster moving fish. And so they can also get entangled in pair trawling, for instance, where you've got these large trawlers going for herring and other small fish, that lobster bait and other things. So it's a niche thing. Each species has its own particular challenges.
And we've had ropeless fishing gear developed. Remind listeners how that technology works and where we are with the use of ropeless gear.
Well, basically, it's using an age-old technology of acoustic release of some kind of bottom gear. So it was started in the 1950s and used by science and research and industry and defense to have things on the bottom, listening devices or whatever, and when you want to get them back, you hit a button acoustically on the vessel above and something buoyant pops up to enable you to grab the device or whatever's attached to it. So in the context of fishing, we, along with many other folks and fishermen and engineers and gear manufacturers over the last 7 or 8 years have been working to develop a way to bring closed areas back into access for lobstermen that need to fish in the winter because the lobsters are good then, the prices are good. And so the way it's been is that locally there's been this gear lending library at the Northeast Fisheries Science Center, and they have used the developing and evolving tools that are being made locally here and elsewhere in the country, in Canada, different brands of quote-unquote ropeless or on-demand fishing where you, when you need to hit the button, it comes back up. And so that's evolved from does the gear work to how do we use it? And so it's working pretty darn well at this point. And there are local fishermen here who get to go out to fish in a closed area that's closed to vertical buoy lines, but it's open to permitted fishing of this gear. And so at the Ropeless Consortium last year, there was a local lobsterman who said, yeah, I paid my mortgage because of the income I had from fishing
with this ropeless
on demand
gear.
With yeah. ropeless gear.
I know it's expensive, right? And that's one of the issues. Are there ways to reduce the cost or other cheaper technologies in the works?
Well, one of the things that I got involved with was a substantial grant from SeaWorld about 5 years ago. Some of the last things I did with that money was to send it to a company on the West Coast to say, look, you know, I see that you've got an order of magnitude cheaper gear than currently being used. Can you make this work? Well, that gear was part of the commercial fishing this winter in these waters. Mm. So, you know, it's not for everybody, but there is definitely a trend downwards in terms of what works for who, where. And it's very a niche thing too, because different depths of water, different currents and different stresses and strains and ways of fishing. So it's complicated, but we definitely are trying to make it more affordable.
So Tor is giving us a call. Hi, Tor.
Oh, hi, Mandy Todd. Hello, and to Dr. Moore. Thank you for having me on.
What's your question?
My question is in terms of a survey of plankton, which is much of my focus as a nature photographer, naturalist, is when we do a survey of where the copepods are and the plankton of all sorts of larval forms, do we see that the Cape Cod Bay is suffering from a lack of broken food chain? And could you tell us more about where the copepods are and how significant it is that these right whales that you've been locating have enough plankton to feed on? And is there a shortage or abundance?
All right, Tor, thanks for the question. Not your area of research, though.
But, yeah, but I can tell you what I've seen.
Okay.
And certainly, as we said earlier, the right whales know when the food is optimal for them. They don't open their mouths unless there's enough food to make it worth their while to do so. And they're obviously feeding well. There's an evolution of where the food is in the water column. So early in the year, January, February, the whales are diving to the bottom and they don't come up except to breathe, and they're not going that deep, so they're not that tired, so it makes it really hard to sort of work with them. But so the species mix changes through the season as well, and the Center for Coastal Studies folks have got a lot of data on that. Mm-hmm. And by the end of the season, hopefully they come back up to the surface to feed as well as to breathe, and then they're a lot more accessible to us photographically. And when you see them skim feeding just below the surface or at the surface, then that is all. The right whales are telling us where the food is in the water column. And some work that was done a long time ago was to put a video plankton recorder in front of a whale, and then they went behind the whale, and it was as if a vacuum cleaner had gone by. There was nothing behind the whale, and there was a lot in front of it. So
yeah.
They're really, really good at finding the food.
Yeah. In your book, We Are All Whalers, you point out that as consumers, we all bear some responsibility for whale ship strikes because so much of what we buy arrives via ships. Has there been a silver lining to the tariffs in that regard?
Well, theoretically, one might surmise that if there aren't so many ships arriving in ports on the East Coast with goods that we consume, the vessel strike risk may decrease.
Dr. Michael Moore is an emeritus research scholar at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and author of We Are the Whalers. You mentioned that website that with the buoys. It's Robots for Whales with the number four, right? Number and we'll four. Put a link at our website, and we'll post links to the book as well. And some of the right whale drone footage we discussed at our website, capeandislands.org. Thanks so much for coming in, and we appreciate all the work that you do to help those whales.
Oh, it's great to talk about them.